Let's start off kind of about your upbringing then and how you kind of got interested in singing and music. So you grew up in Baltimore, is that correct?
Yeah, I grew up in Baltimore area. From a young age, I've always been in talent shows and singing and dancing. A little background about the group. We actually started out as a breakdance group before we even started singing it together. And so we kind of have a history of entertaining. I was called in high school by my teachers the human dust mop. Actually, me and Larry McFarland, one of the other members of the group, because we were spinning on our backs, every moment that we had. So we
Really?
had a pretty, yes, yeah. So we had a pretty good time when we were growing up as teenagers, and we really stayed in the scene, just everything that we could get into, any kind of contest. And then we started rapping, we started singing, we did a little bit of everything during that time.
How did you ever get into the Michael Jackson dance moves, a little moonwalk or anything?
Yeah, that was me. I had the socks, the match the shirt and the pants, high water pants and penny loafers, and the little Jerry Carroll, and doing the spins. Yes, I was Michael Jackson for a little while.
What about the white MC Hammer pants? Remember those?
Yeah, you know what? I didn't necessarily wear the hammer pants, but was doing the shabadoo. You remember from Breaking?
Yeah.
Yeah, so did wear the shabadoo pants.
I love the 90s. So you mentioned Larry, and then of course Roberto and Ray are
Yes.
in the group as well. So were you guys friends pretty much growing up? And then how did you guys meet before you formed the group?
Well, Larry and I, we met in high school. He comes from a military background, and there's a military base close to where we grew up. And so we met in ninth grade, and I thought he was the coolest dude I've ever seen. He came in with the pointy toe shoes and the parachute pants and little leather tie. And we're kind of like a small town outside of Baltimore. And so I was kind of a nerd. I had the Izod sweaters, the V-necks, and slacks, and during that time, and we hit it off immediately. I just wanted to know what this kid was all about, and so we were really close, and then we started breakdancing, and then we met Ray at a breakdance contest. He was with another group, and we battled, and then afterwards we decided we would form a group together, and Bobby Roberto is actually Ray's older brother, and at the time he was still in the Bronx, and New York, and he had a group there, a singing group called The Pleasures at the time, and we used to sneak off and drive up to New York, or get up there any way we could, and see some of their shows. If our parents knew that we were traveling from Baltimore to New York at 14 or 15 years old, they'd probably have a fit, but we had to be around what was going on, and Ray, being from the Bronx himself, he kind of turned us on to that, and we started traveling up the 95 and hitting New York and watching them perform, and that kind of put the bug in us at that point.
Well, and then you kind of decided. Did you move to New York then? Because the group was first called For Real, right? The IV Real before it was 4 PM.
Right. No, actually, Bobby moved down to Maryland, and that's when the collaboration kind of started to happen. This happened. That was after we've actually graduated high school and we're kind of doing our thing at this point. I was in the military. I went into the Army right after high school, and I served in Desert Storm, and I came back. And I was stationed at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. And when I got back, I bought some keyboards, some sequencers, and microphones, and I started playing around and doing my own recording. And it wasn't until actually my fifth year high school reunion that we got back together. I met up with Larry, and we went into my car, and I popped in a cassette and let him hear some of the music I was doing, and he was like, "Wow, man, we gotta get together." And so we wound up rounding up Ray, and then his brother Bobby was living in the area at the time, and we had a little mini studio set up in my apartment in Silver Spring, Maryland at the time, and we started making music, And that's kind of how For Real came about.
So you really, those first 5 years after high school, you really had no idea or, you know, no realistic expectation of getting signed or anything. It just kind of happened.
Yeah, I would say once we got together and started doing music, we thought we were good enough to get a deal. So we went to New York and we had a friend who worked for some of the record pools, you know, the DJ record pools at the time. And so he knew some inside people and he actually got us in front of, I can't remember the A&R guy, his one of the guys from Atlantic Records. And we were trying to push our tape, but he said, hey, you know, that stuff you guys used to do, that doo-wop stuff, you know, when with Bobby's group, and do you guys know any of that stuff? Can you do that? And we said, well, you know, we did play around with it. And so we started singing songs that Bobby's group, The Pleasures, used to sing. And the harmonies clicked without us practicing. They just clicked. And they were like, wow, we want to sign you guys. And they connected us with Bobby Eli from Blue Magic and down in Philly. And we went down there and made a recording, and we sound like we were from the 60s. So that wasn't the sound that was going to work for us. You know, we didn't have that Boys to Men kind of a thing going on. We had our own unique sound, so that didn't work. But so that deal didn't go through, but we figured out that we were good enough for them to have that much interest in us. If we keep practicing, we can get another deal. So that's what kind of started the whole 4 p.m. and saying that we can make, get a record deal if we really practice. So we started writing our own songs and practicing. We practiced practically every day. None of us really played. I played keyboards, but I wasn't comfortable saying that I was really good at it. So we did most of our music a cappella, and kind of just started to steamroll from that point.
Well, and then so a two-part question about the name then. So first of all, how did you guys choose 4 p.m.? And then second of all, I've always thought it was kind of cool what that stood for and means. So kind of explain that.
Okay, well, For Real, if you remember, there was a female group called For Real. And we had the name first. David, did I lose you?
No, I'm here.
Okay. Yeah, we had the name first, and but they put their record out first, so we had to change our name. And or we chose to change our name. And because of the music that we were doing was clean, clean cut, because we did a lot of family events. We were doing barbecues all the time, a lot of things with family. And we couldn't imagine ourselves doing bump and grind music in front of, you know, aunts, uncles, and grandmothers. it just fit us to be, when we were trying to figure out what we were going to call ourselves, you know, 4 p.m. for positive music that just kept ringing, and it stuck with us. And it's something that we really stand behind, the for positive music. That was our motto, that we would never do music that would be offensive to our grandmothers if they were to listen to it.
So you don't think little Ruth would be bumping and grinding to it?
Oh, no. No. But, you know, the funny thing is that we were on tour. We were on, like, with, what is that girl that, 20 Fingers? you know, that short man,
yeah.
Song?
Yeah.
Yeah. We were, like, on tour with groups like that all the time. And it was, like, it just was killing us that, you know, we had this name, 4 p.m. for positive music, and this is what they team us up with when we're out there doing all these radio tours.
So that's great. That'd be kind of like Tim Tebow at a Lil Wayne concert or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So we're talking to Martiz right now from 4 p.m. So then you mentioned like the barbecues and kind of, you know, doing that and getting really good, you know, becoming experts at your craft. So then early 94 is, you know, kind of when you got your record deal, the big break. So what do you remember about that day, and how did you guys get signed as 4 p.m.?
All right. Well, I tell a different story than the rest of the guys because I was very involved in this. I was still in the Army at the time, and I had to make a decision of whether I was going to get out or stay in. And I decided that I thought we were good enough, so I did not reenlist, and I let my time expire. So this is I got out of the military May 1994, At this time, the guys were kind of starting to settle and think that things may not happen. But after I gave up my military career, I wasn't going to let it stop. So the guy that we were dealing with as our manager, John Ferry, we planned a party, but we didn't have it set in stone. So we didn't know exactly if we were going to be able to make it happen or not. But my job was to get the guys to New York. So I made up a story about the party, and it was somewhat true, but it wasn't. And while he was working on trying to see who can get together to hear us. So we went up to New York. We wound up staying in the Bronx at one of the guy's cousin's house. And to make money and to eat, because I was really the only one that had money at the time. A couple of the guys were unemployed at that point. So we went to Grand Central Station, and we started singing doo-wop and some of our a cappella songs. And we made in an hour about $150. And we were like, wow. And, you know, and the police, you're not allowed to do that without a permit. But I guess we sounded good enough that the police stood back and let us stay there for at least an hour before they decided to move us along. So we wound up staying there about a week, and we still didn't have anything, and they were getting restless and wanting to go home because we were making up excuses of why the party didn't happen yet. And then John finally was able to get Eddie O'Loughlin from Next Plateau Records and some of his staff and some other people to come to a party in his apartment. He had an apartment in Battery Park in New York, not too far from the World Trade Center. And they all showed up, and we went shopping at Macy's from the money that we made down in the subway, and showed up to the party looking good. And we started singing a cappella, and Eddie O'Loughlin approached us and said, you know, you guys are good, but we need a song. I haven't heard anything that is that intriguing to me. And that got us excited. And we were trying to figure out, okay, what is this song going to be? What are we going to come back to Eddie O'Loughlin with that's going to blow him away? And lo and behold, he actually called us about a week later and said, I want you guys to try Sukiyaki and see what you think. And we've listened to it, and we were like, what are we going to do with this song? You know, the Taste of Honey version. And we were like, okay. And, you know, it took us no more than about a half an hour to come up with an arrangement. And we sang it to him over the phone, and he was like, you guys need to come back up to New York. I want to hear this in person. I want you guys to put it on tape, and I want to see if it sounds as good in person as it does over the phone. So we hurry up and gathered our things and traveled up to New York and got into the studio with our producers, Jerry and Morrow, and we put together actually the version that is out, that came out, was really about 90% of the version that we did just as a demo to give Eddie to let him just so he can hear what we came up with.
So that's actually the one that's on the radio pretty much then, huh?
Yeah. You know, some of the music originally was all a cappella. You know, the music that's behind the that's backing up the version is Mauro DeSantis, and he did an awesome job and threw in some of the harp sounds, and that really, I think, made the record complete at that point. So from May 94 to July 20th was the actual release date of our first single. So there was 2 months of hustle that got us to that point, you know, and a lot of God that was involved in making sure that it happened, because I don't think anybody can say that 2 months, you know, after you really put your heart to it, you'll get, you know, you get some, most people get signed to a, you know, a major record deal.
So what were your expectations then for that song? Did you think it would explode like it did, or did you not have a clue, or what? You know, what do you remember about that?
Didn't have a clue. Just remember, by August it was right there, right at the top 100 portion of it, and right around September, it was starting to move down close to the top 40 marks, and we were just blown away. We didn't know what to expect. And our local radio station in Baltimore, KPCC, we were trying to get them to play the song, and we had everyone we could think of to call it. And I remember we were all staying up late because they said they were going to play it. And it was about 2:30 in the morning before they finally played it for the first time on our own local station. And, you know, it kind of hurt us a little bit because other places in the United States were already playing us, but we couldn't get our own local station there in Baltimore to get on board right away. But it wasn't far after that that it started to really take off.
Yeah, and then they probably wanted you on for interviews shortly after that. They're your best friends then, right?
Oh yeah. So we did, no hard feelings. We need radio. You know, any artist, you need radio. That's the main push for any type of promotion. That's how you were heard. And so, you know, we did everything that we could for radio. I think we went above and beyond what we could. We started doing a lot of the tags for radio stations, incorporating our song into the tag, and sent it throughout the whole country without anyone telling us to do it. It was something that we decided to do.
Smart. Yeah, that's very good. I love the music video, by the way, where you guys are kind of on the balcony, and then there's that random hot chick in bed. So
yeah.
Where was the music video for that filmed at, and then what do you remember about that day?
Well, we shot the video in Chinatown in New York, and that was probably one of the most exciting days, you know, that we've had. You know, MTV was really big at that point, so the fact that we were doing a music video was awesome. I mean, it was like beyond any of our dreams at that point. Even more than making the record, it was like being on MTV was going to be our biggest dream. And Matt Dillon actually showed up while we were on set, because he had an apartment not too far from there. And then the group For Real, the female group, actually came around on set. And it was an amazing experience. We filmed early in the morning until about 12 midnight that night. And it's funny because we really only stayed on that that fire escape the whole time. And you know, it was just exciting. We wanted to do more, but that just seemed to be that was the shot. And you know, and that's what everyone remembers, the fire escape scenes.
Who was that the beautiful girl in the video? Was it some random girl? Do you know who she is?
She was a model. Didn't really have any much you know, information on her. It was someone that the director of the video had picked. And she was perfect for it. And of course, with our name being For Positive Music, there was some pushback on what she was going to wear. So to kind of make it more, instead of it being so too, you know, overly sexy, we made sure, if you notice, she has socks on. And you know, it's funny, the socks makes a difference. You know, with someone in lingerie laying on a bed, but if they have socks on, it makes it a little bit more innocent.
That is true. I've never thought of that before, but that's a good point. So any other favorite songs off that first album, Now's the Time? Anything when you look back, any songs that mean a lot to you?
Well, I wrote two of the songs on the album. I wrote Yes, and I wrote Forward More. And then one of the other favorite songs is Father and Child, that was written by Roberto. Yes is actually... I'm actually getting married April 21st this year, and that is a song that I sing to my fiance as an engagement song. So it really has a lot of meaning to me.
Well, congratulations on that. So
Thank you.
Did you meet her after the 4 p.m. days then?
Yes.
Did she believe that you were from 4 p.m., and did she know who you were before you met her?
Yeah, it took a little while for it to sink in. The first time I met her, because she's Filipino, I actually sang a song to her in Filipino. And she kind of looked at me like, is this guy for real? You know, where did he learn this song from? Or how did he do this? Where does this come from? And, you know, after we we got to know each other a little bit more. Then she found out that I was actually, you know, from a singing group, but she's not a groupie. She's actually doesn't even you know, she makes me takes my head down when I get a big head sometimes. You're like, yeah, that was back in the day. No big deal anymore.
Did she know Sukiyaki from, you know, did she remember it from when it came out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And all her friends and her family, they all think it's a really big deal. And they all remember the song. So it's really cool when I'm around them. And you know, the funny thing is that, you know, we go to to karaoke, and they have the 4 p.m. version of Sukiyaki. And, you know, the first time I tried to sing it on karaoke, I got like a 60 score.
You're the actual artist.
Believe me. I did terrible. I couldn't understand it.
That had to have been a blow to the ego, right?
Yeah, it was.
That's great. Do you ever get recognized anymore, by the way? Like, does anybody ever come up to you and be like, are you that guy from 4 p.m.? Does that happen?
No, but on Facebook, it happens. It happens. They ask if I'm the, you know, Martez, the guy from 4 p.m., but not as much. It's just face-to-face anymore. When I first came out to California, I did get that. And especially that, you know, with some Japanese-American when I worked at a school, I was a director of a vocational school, and we had some students that came from Japan, and they kept looking at me, and then finally one of them asked me, were you at 4 p.m.? And as soon as I said yes, it was just, they were bringing all kinds of things in me to sign, and pictures and CDs. They had everything. So I was like, wow, this is incredible.
Well, you guys are huge in Japan. I remember reading about that.
Yeah, it was. We were a huge success there. We did a lot of television and some endorsements there. So we really went over well in Japan. And I mean, today, even today, I still have a lot of friends on Facebook from Japan that stay in touch with. And, you know, they're waiting for us to come back and see them again. So I'm looking forward toward that day as well.
That'd be cool. Yeah. What was I going to ask you? I had something good I was going to ask you, too. Now I forget what it was. Anyway, we're talking to Martez right now from 4 p.m. So then the second album came out in 1997, A Light in the Dark was that
yes.
one. So, you know, y'all, I forget the quote, you have a lifetime to make your first album and 6 months to the second. I mean, did you feel a lot of pressure going into that second album to duplicate the success of the first one?
There was a lot of pressure because we weren't sure what sound the record company wanted from us. We wanted to stay true to our sound. And, you know, from 94 to 97, there was a total different sound in radio at that time. It kind of changed. And so we wanted to stay relevant, but we didn't want to lose our true, you know, our true sound. So it was difficult to try to figure out what songs and how to produce these songs and, you know, what amount of the songs are a cappella and what with music and so on. So it was a very different experience with this with that album.
You had I Gave You Everything did really good on the R&B charts. Kind of tell us how that song was born.
That song was actually another song presented to us by Eddie O'Loughlin. It wasn't no longer Next Plateau, but he had had a deal with Roadrunner Records. And that was one of the songs that he presented to us. He thought we would do a good job. And we immediately liked the song. We thought it fit our style. And so it was pretty fun recording. We had a few different versions of it. And so the percapella, which was kind of with a drum beat and a cappella, and then the full arrangement were two versions that made it on the album.
And then after that second album, you guys kind of took a little break, and then ultimately you'd leave the group around 98, I guess it was. So how come you guys first took a break, and then what made you choose to kind of move on from that?
Well, for me, I really put my entire heart into the music and the music industry, and it didn't seem like the music industry treated me well, gave me the same back as I put into it. And it was starting to become what I would call an expensive hobby, where instead of getting paid to do what we love, it was costing more to do what we loved. And so I needed to start making some decisions. And I decided to come out to California and try to pursue producing and writing. And that was very difficult for me to open the doors that were open before. It's the industries, it can be pretty tough. And so I went back to school and got my degree and in business. I started out in computers and in business, and found my love teaching. I started teaching computers, and it felt like being in front of a, you know, when you're in front of students, it's like being in front of an audience. You know, you have their undivided attention, and you're filling their minds with you know, with information. And that's how I felt it was when we were singing that songs that we sung. We were spreading a message of you know, peace and love and so on. And so I had a chance to do that as a teacher, and I fell in love with education, and I'm still in that same realm today. So I think it was a good move on my part.
Oh, that's cool. That sounds like you got no regrets and it worked out.
Oh, no, not at all.
Yeah, that's great. Now, how about Ray Roberto and Larry? What are they up to these days? You guys still keep in touch and everything?
Oh, yeah. Well, Ray and Roberto, they're still scrambling, trying to, you know, doing things here and there. Larry is actually a CEO of a prison at a prison. And he's funny because he's such a small guy. We used to call him Barney Fife when he would come with his uniform on. So everyone is still dibbling and dabbling in music and doing different things. Nothing professional. Larry has a full studio that he's working with some local kids and things in the area. I know Ray is singing. He's in New Jersey now, singing, just doing some things around the city. And Bobby, he still writes, and but hasn't really done anything, you know, music related. And for myself, I'm singing Christian music now, and have gone to the Philippines a couple of times with my church, doing missions work and giving concerts and singing to those affected. Just this February, we were there to help those affected by the Typhoon Sadong that hit in the Philippines and displaced several thousand people there. And I think that's my calling, going out and to some of the especially impoverished areas in the world, and just singing trying to bring joy as much as I can to those who are suffering.
Do you have any students anymore that recognize you or ask you to sign stuff?
It happens occasionally. Usually it's their brother or sister.
Yeah.
That once they find out, they tell their brother or sister or maybe an aunt or even their mom's mother or father in some cases. And they'll send some stuff in to see if I can sign it for them. You know, that was my favorite group back in the 90s.
That's got to be kind of cool. So when you look back, any favorite memories of touring, like any groups that you guys were with or any radio shows or anything that sticks out as kind of your favorite?
One of the memories that sticks out, we when we came out to California, one of the first times we came out, we connected with Delius and Jamie and those guys from All for One. And we went to Six Flags, which is one of the big amusement parks here, Six Flags Magic Mountain. And when we got to the gate, we had no idea that that our status was as high as it was. And they wanted to close down the park for us to go in. And we were like, no, we can't, you know, we don't want this to do that. But then they were like, well, we have to have security with you guys when we go. And so they actually had security with us. And we were walking around the park, and we went to this, you know, people are looking at us like, that looks like All for One and 4 p.m. You know, they weren't sure. And then we started having a crowd follow us. And the crowd started getting bigger and bigger. And we went to a food court area, And we wound up setting up around a table, and the both of us started going back and forth with a cappella songs. And, you know, it was just like a jam session. And the kids and their parents and, you know, from young and old were all coming around, and it was very peaceful, and they were just listening to us. And then there was a boy group that came up to us, and they started singing one of the songs I wrote, the For What More. And I thought that was really cool. So we became friends, actually, and I still stay in touch with those guys as well. And so that was one of those times that really stuck out. We really had a good time, and we really became good friends with All For One. And I'm still in touch with Delius to this day.
Huh. And then, like, when you look back, what are you most proud of from 4PM? I mean, you know, when you look back at it, what makes you most proud about that?
I think the you know, we worked really hard to get the deal, and we did everything that we could to put our message out there, you know, positive music. And we were successful at it. I really believe we could have had a number one record if things weren't, kind of crazy between the record companies at the time, because it seemed like one half of the country was playing us while the other one didn't know what to do with us yet. And the fact that we made a top 10 hit and we went gold and platinum and you know, here in the United States, Canada, and other countries was a big accomplishment, because we didn't think we would be that big. And so we're brothers, you know, the four of us became closer than we've ever been. And so that, you know, can't take anything away from that experience.
Is there any unreleased 4PM stuff that we might hear someday, or is all of it out there?
No, you know what? There is. I have DATs and cassettes and of music that didn't make it on the albums that I pulled out and was listening to not too long ago. It was hard for me to find a cassette player. And all the cassette players are broken, or someone says, don't put it in there, it might eat your tape. So you remember those days.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, but there are some things that you possibly may hear, later on. And if it's not us doing it, maybe it's one of our kids. I have a daughter who's a music major here at Cal State Long Beach, and that's what she wants to do. She wants to be famous, is what she tells me. So, some of the music from 4PM that didn't make it the first time, you might hear it again through the songs of someone else.
Well, maybe we'll be hearing from her one of these days, right?
Oh, yeah. Looking forward to that.